Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package gonna go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So, if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Why am I mad? You know, white people ask me, why am I so angry? And, you know, I don't have any answer for him, because it'd be ridiculous for me to answer him, because he couldn't understand anyway, obviously, because he asked me the question.
Hey, call me Louis. This is my sport. Louis.
I don't agree with the moderator nor Reverend Robinson that we want some kind of agreement. We want agreement by which we can live or die. You choose. I have spoken to you a lot of times in hatred and anger, and you have not heard me. Well, you had better hear me today. It's because you consider me a vagabond leader that I'm not to speak here. Well, you had better cut those neckties off of them black boys that you put in our districts, because they don't know what's happening. And I'm from the pits of nigger hell, and I know what's happening. If you won't listen to me when I make an appeal for the Negroes, because you have no concern for the Negroes, listen to me when I make an appeal for America. You claim you love America. Well, we love America, but you are driving us back, and you are making a Samson out of us, and we are going to pull down the pillars. Should you try to pretend that I'm crazy because I want America to be saved? Riot that goes on in this country and in this city. The city is better than Pittsburgh. And then you think we have no right to ask for something? Is it too much to ask you to grant us human dignity? Should we be put down and shot to death for this request? If so, you can aim your guns. What the hell do you think we care about dying if you're going to deny us the right to live?
The 400 years that I've existed there, 3 years, you know, 3 generations within my own family, why don't you know what I'm like? What is it so new in 1968 or, you know, in the 60s that you've got to learn? Because my grandfather was born, you know, he's 90. My mother was ready for integration. You know, she's middle-class Negro. Now, all of a sudden, you come to me and you say, you know, communicate with me. Hell, I've been here all the time.
And we've been
Where were you?
Communicate.
Now, what do I have to say to you? The most advanced nation in the world. It has to be resolved. It has to be resolved because I want my children to have an answer. If not me. I personally prefer that I have an answer. You know, I don't have, you know, I like to think I don't have my lifetime to waste on this.
We're not interested in interracial housing. We don't want your neighborhood. We want ours to be just as good. See? We don't want a store in your neighborhood, but we don't want you coming in our neighborhood and opening up stores and exploiting us and then go home and throw a bomb if we move next door out in the suburbs. We don't want your schools, but we want our schools to be the highest and the best possible for our black progeny. See, what people don't understand, we are sane and we're not asking. You see? The die is cast, as I said. We're not asking. We're saying this is the way it's going to be.
Gentleman in the back row.
My name is Russell Davis. I'm a student of political science. This afternoon, Mr. Meeks has said that he's not afraid of alienating white America. The young lady from Winnetka has stated that she saw during the marches which she participated in people who were full of fear and hatred. Mr. Lucas has said that the American Negro is either going to be free or he's going to be dead. My question is this. If the violence continues, aren't you, Mr. Meeks, and you, Mr. Lucas, afraid that it's going to be the second alternative?
Can I answer that? Mr. Meeks, quickly.
Let me answer this, gentlemen. You know, it's very hard to say what you want to say when, after you've said it, somebody gets some answer that you haven't been talking. But you know what, young white fellow? I got a son in the 101st Airborne that you're going to kill, probably, because he's going to Vietnam. I got a nephew who just came back from Korea that was wounded 3 times. The first thing happened, he went home, but a cop beat the hell out of him with a pistol butt. Now, you get this straight. You can kill all the black folks you want to, baby, but you will not kill the freedom of black folks. It's coming. We're going to get it. You think you're so indestructible. You think you're so great because you got all these weapons. I remember Mao Zedong once said he wondered where he'd get his weapons from, and then we armed Chiang Kai-shek. And he said, thank you, Jesus. You see? So don't misunderstand us, baby. We're dead serious. This country was founded on revolution. Those little settlers out there in the northeast section of this country had some muskets and some sticks and some stones. And they whipped the mighty professional British army, baby. And 5,000 of them were black, and one black woman disguised herself as a man and fought with you all. And we don't have our freedom yet. We fought in every one of your damn lousy wars, baby, and you give us nothing. Now, the war is going to be here because we're going to be free. Now, you kill all you want to, but we kill too.
Most people say, if you don't like it here, get out. That's for spineless people, spineless bastards who don't want to fight for what they believe in. Well, I'm staying here because I was born here, and I am going to fight for my freedom. And before I have kids, I am going to make sure that this damn United States deserves the existence of my kids, because I will not rest until every Sunday school is safe for my kids, so that they won't get killed or beaten up like those kids down in Mississippi in 1966. That is going to stop, or else I'll be dead. Either one, you white folks have either one of two choices. give me my damn freedom or kill me. Because I am tired of sitting by being an Uncle Tom or a house Negro like Booth and Wilkins. Those two guys are not Negroes. They're white people with man's hand. That's all. They don't speak for us. They have found their way into the white man's house, the white man's establishment, and they are not about to make waves. But I am, because I am not going to take seeing my kids walking to a newly integrated school and getting their heads whipped in by grown men. Because if that happens to my kids, there are going to be a lot of damn dead white folks, and I mean a lot, because I am not going to take this junk no more. The days of step and fetch it are dead. The days of the plat face, big wide-eyed, gin-drinking black man are dead. Now we have what is called black consciousness.
You know, this revolution is filled with so many ironies, really. First you tell us that it is manly to keep your word. All right, if you are a man, you keep your word. And now all that the black people in this country are demanding, and even the black people in the whole world are demanding, is that you keep your word. You told us we were free. Well, then show us that we're free. You told us that there is justice, equality for all in this country. Well, then stick to your word and let us see the justice and equality for all. Or else admit to us that you're not a man. You're a worm. You're afraid of us. You're afraid to give us equal stand. You're afraid that if you give us equal ground, that we will match you and we will override you. And if that's what you're afraid of us, then tell us that just what you're afraid of. But don't keep hiding it from us and holding this up to us. And every time we ask you for something, you give us a little bit of something. And it's all tokenism. We don't want tokenism. And there are most black men in this world that don't want charity. And yet still every time we ask you for something, you give us a little piece, a little piece. You're playing games with us. We're not children. We're big men. I've seen my father have to put up with all kinds of stuff. He was a big man. He raised a family. He went down south and he had to go around to the back door with his wife. We're not asking for anything. We're not asking for any favors. All we want is what's ours. Now, there are many black veterans who are coming back, and they're mad. They're angry. Do you think that they're going to sit down through this? Our fathers didn't have the knowledge that we had. They sat through it. But there are other black youth that are not going to sit through it. We know about Che. We know about Fanon. We've read the books of our revolution. We've listened to Mao and his quotations. We know where we stand. We're not going to sit for it. We're asking, and if we ask and we don't get, we're prepared to stand up and take it. If I ask a man, I tell a man I am hungry. I tell him I am cold. And I ask him to do something about my condition. And this man holds a loaf of bread right in front of me so I can see it. And I keep asking him, I'm begging him to please give me a slice of the loaf of bread. I am hungry. Then it is known by every psychologist that the next step in the progression is I am going to knock him upside the head and take the bread from him. I'm not going to starve to death. All we're asking, no one wants to see blood. No one likes the smell of blood. No one wants war. Anyone who's been in war doesn't want war. Everyone knows what it is to see the inside of a man's gut hanging out and see your friends die, see relatives die. No one wants to regress back to the state of mind where you have to think it's all for the cause, therefore my mother has to die, my wife has to die, my brothers and sisters have to die. No one wants that. But you're pushing us to it. You're leaving us no choice. We're asking, we're begging. The students up at Columbia, they ask. The brothers down south ask. The brothers in Latin America, the brothers in Africa, they're all asking. All they're doing is asking. Our fathers ask. Our grandfathers ask. The presidents of our universities, our colleges, had to go to your back doors to beg that their children be given just enough money so that they could be taught something to live off. And yet still, they ask and ask and ask, and you refuse to give them anything. Now, we're just about out of patience. We're not going to ask anymore. The news media says that it's only the young that are militant, only the young that want this and want that. Okay, but we're 40% of the black population now. Or we were a year ago, and still yet we're climbing. Before long, we'll be 50%, 55%, and then we'll have the command. We're not going to take it. We're not going to take sitting in rotten parks and places that just aren't fit for living. We're not going to take it. There's a limit to a man's patience, and everyone knows that God, Christ, heaven, everyone knows that what we're asking is not $1 million. All we're asking for is humanity. We're asking to be allowed to live like human beings. And God, you tell us that this is too much to ask. You're sick. You're definitely sick. How can you tell me that it's too much to ask to be a human being?
Let me put it to you this way. We are proud of being black and of our black heritage. But white America does not accept the concept that this is a multiracial society. It has never accepted the fact that there are black people, brown people, yellow people here alongside them. They've always looked upon America as being white. And hence, all of its propaganda is directed at us to convince us that somehow or other we must become white before they will accept us.
The problem is the standard for discussion is set by the whites. And a lot of Negroes now don't want to accept that standard anymore. They say we're going to have our own standard. I think that the hookup comes if you can develop a whole new standard where whites and Negroes can have a dialogue. Not either one of those are acceptable anymore. I mean, whites aren't going to accept Negro standards, and Negroes no longer want to be white. So that the clear thing is to develop a whole new standard, and then everybody move toward that. So there can be some kind of dialogue.
You know, from a child up, I always, at first, I wanted to be white, you know, because my family was 20 of us, 6 girls and 14 boys. We would make 50 and 60 bales of cotton, gather all that cotton, and we wouldn't have food in the wintertime. So I figured then the white people must be right. But as I got older, I said, no, it's something wrong. And if I ever get a chance, I'm going to do something about it. I'm thinking about in terms of a better and a greater world for all people. And we can't do that by me in one corner doing what I can do to hurt you and you in the other corner doing the same thing against me.
Well, why is it that black people don't own the land where they live? White people own that land. We've never been taught property values. You see, we've never been taught property values. I don't own Harlem, for example. Black people don't own Harlem. So who gives a damn whether Harlem burned down or not? How you going to tell me to love this property that exploits me every day when the average black man in Harlem works the first Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday for a landlord? And on Thursday, he's working for Con Edison. And on Friday, he works for himself. And he's got the day off on Saturday, and he buys him a drink of liquor. And the minute he gets drunk, then a white policeman arrests him, takes him in a white court, and takes his money for 2 other weeks. And he goes in debts for the rest. And he goes to a white landlord, goes to a white pawn shop, or else he goes to another white loan shop to keep living on credit to pay off the white man. And he's paying taxes and profits and vacation pay for white people. So the average black man ain't got nothing to lose by anything that he does. And this is what the white man better understand. Nothing from nothing leaves nothing. Simple. As A, B, C. Or as 1, 2, 3, any way you go. There's no need asking me why these black people burning down these buildings out here. Hell, they got a positive answer. And people are not as dumb as people would think. With all the brilliant white psychiatrists and psychologists You've been able to find a damn path to the moon, but you ain't been able to find one goddamn path 1 mile up the street. Maybe you better take time with just all this unique ability to find all these scientific discoveries that you've got to learn how to find your way into men's hearts and the men's minds.
Thank you.
Shakir, thanks so much for your time. So tell us a little bit about this company that you're backing so much.
So it's a company which was made up by a number of people with experience in the industry coming together, leveraging off the knowledge they had to first acquire a division of a company and then expand into direct manufacturing. So they have been operating for the last couple of years, but what's launching tomorrow is the opening of the manufacturing site.
Sure. So you say they're in water, the first black manufacturer of water treatment and sanitation products. I suppose it goes without saying that this is quite a smart move to manufacture in, given the crisis of water supply we find ourselves in as a country.
And it's especially important for the municipalities, but also for various companies in the food industry who require sanitation and water treatment as well. So both the private and the public sector.
Mm. What was it, you know, other than the fact that they've identified quite a niche market to play in, but what was it about these specific manufacturers that the IDC thought were worth, you know, backing?
They're people who knew the industry, who have a range of technical and marketing skills. They had the vision, they developed their plans, they knew what they wanted to do. They were prepared to do the work and make the sacrifice to actually make it work.
And what are sales? Are you able to reveal what sales and profits of this company are currently looking like or could be looking like should things go their way?
So what I can say is that they've secured a number of blue chip customers. So their sales prospects are actually very good. They have actually been selling already. They've been doing some trading and toll manufacturing, so they've got an established base. And in fact, they've already started exporting as well.
Very interesting and quite, you know, a big congratulations is due to them. But, you know, Shakir, we've just had GDP figures coming out pointing to a continued pressure in this manufacturing sector that players like Kivalu operate in. I mean, in terms of outlook, are you worried about the long-term prospects given the kind of economic numbers that we're seeing?
So that's a short-term concern, the downturn. In the long term, we're quite positive. And in fact, companies that are filling a gap like Kivalu is filling within the value chain actually helps reduce the cost for other manufacturers. So actually there is potential for more of these manufacturers coming in of a range of products which will be needed and which will add value.
Reduced costs, how so?
So as opposed to importing intermediate chemicals for the food industry, for example, if we have a local manufacturer, it actually reduces the import costs, it reduces the transport costs, it makes it more competitively available for them.
I mean, you were talking about the fact that they export as well, because we do know that quite a lot of manufacturers that are listed on the stock exchange, the big guys, have been also having challenges because the rand was a lot stronger. I mean, it's a little bit weaker now, but to what degree is the currency a bit of a headwind for players like Kivalu?
The currency is a big headwind, and in fact, it's not only how strong the currency is, but the fact that it fluctuates, which makes it very difficult to plan your working capital and so on, and one day you're selling at a profit and the next day at a loss. In Kivalu's case, one thing which assists them is they are actually following their major customers to their markets overseas. So they've got a local relationship, and they're utilizing of that to export.
And are you able to tell us who some of those customers are?
Well, a major customer at the moment is SAB InBev.
Wow, all right. So quite a giant for a customer there. So you're quite secure.
So that's one of the things when we look at it from a risk point of view. The fact that they've got a strong market base, it helps a lot.
But Shakir, just tell us overall, give us an update. How is this Black Industrialist program going?
It's actually going very well. So IDC has put substantial funding into the sector.
How much is it? 1 billion rand now?
No, it's a lot more. So we've allocated 20 billion over 5 years, and we're well on track to achieve that. And the DTI, in parallel with that, has made grant funding available. So in fact, including in Kivalu, we've actually worked together on funding them. So both are successes. And why it works well for us is a lot of the prospective and relatively new industrialists don't have the funding to put in terms of equity.
Sure.
And through the Black Industrialist Grant making the equity portion available, then it makes it easier for IDC to fund it and manage the rest of the risk.
Sure. One question for you. I recall, how old is this program now? It's around 2 or 3 years since it was first announced?
Yes.
So the issue of disruption wasn't quite as big as it is right now. The issue of, you know, having to be smarter about the way you manufacture wasn't quite as big as it is right now. To what degree has, you know, the not even the advent, because we're fully in this fourth industrial revolution now, to what degree has that changed the way you look at the companies that you'll approve for this program?
So we don't restrict ourselves to things which are cutting edge or fourth industrial revolution. But what we do is assess the business prospect and will it be able to be competitive locally and internationally. So a lot depends on the entrepreneur themselves, their vision, how they put things together. And if you look at the range of companies that we have supported, some are traditional old industries and some are quite cutting edge as well.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here. But the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they'd span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe. But they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at UPA in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of UPA's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not UPA. To slash costs and stay competitive, UPA builds its own parts on site. So Mr. Huss' supplier is only a bike ride away. But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock. Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day. When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. UPA started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year, but UPA wants more. Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. UPA's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. He finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, six production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China, competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly line. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism...
I'm a ref being chased out of town after the worst game of my career. You forget one down, and the whole stadium turns on you. And if you have cut rate insurance, it may not pay for all this. You get Allstate. You can save money and be better protected from mayhem, like me.
Shop less, get more. Make one call to an Allstate agent.
The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only two daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work, and there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute, and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply
depot.
The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yupa in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me.
Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa Management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yupa. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin. And Li needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop.
I'm a ref being chased out of town after the worst game of my career. You forget one down and the whole stadium turns on you. And if you have cut rate insurance, they may not pay for all this. So get Allstate. You can save money and be better protected from mayhem, like me.
Shop less, get more. Make one call to an Allstate.
Lee expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, we still didn't have much food to eat.
Now, food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasoning that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy.
After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Shin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job? Address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenant's rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low. Yupa has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Who keeps them in line?
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. But they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit. A veteran on these streets, Fu recognizes this woman. He busted her once before. Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at Yupa.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different, so I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of Yupa's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? Yupa offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games. These sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Fu's mission at one of the world's biggest factories. A place with no boundaries between work and life. For Fu, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle. A company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside Yupa's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. Yupa's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, Yupa has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. Yupa's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice. To thrive and survive, Yupa must develop a new generation of products. The factory's very existence depends on it. Thousands of jobs hang in the balance.
No work means not being able to live. This is a fundamental requirement. It's how humans survive. You have to earn money to make a living, and to earn money, you have to work.
Ji Rong Pan knows how high the stakes are. He is Yupa's Vice President of Product Innovation.
I think innovation is the competitive edge of our company. Because our company is in the field of home appliances, and the whole home appliance industry is a lifestyle industry.
Mr. Pan sent his staff overseas to study the lifestyle products of the future. They returned with a simple message. The future is green.
We studied the consumers of North America and Europe and their thoughts on this new energy of the future. So we know that their love of the earth is actually very strong.
Pan and his designers make a bold decision. The first appliance in Yupa's new product line will be powered by the sun. It's a solar CD player.
We want to bring this clean solar energy concept into people's homes.
Going solar may sound easy, but solar panels are expensive, and they're meant to work outside, not in the dim corners of people's homes. A 3D image of Yupa's appliance of the future starts to emerge. Now the team must turn a digital design into reality.
This factory is a very important part of our development process. It helps turn a product concept into a finished prototype.
Using the design specs, a computerized milling machine cuts a foam cast. And the cast is converted into a hard plastic prototype. If things go according to plan, the model will be used to produce millions of identical copies.
It allows us to test the product to see if this fulfills our requirements while bringing value to the customers.
Now engineers perfect the solar power system. The system must collect and store solar energy. Every aspect of design must maximize energy efficiency.
We've spent a lot of time studying this. What kind of technology, what kind of material, what kind of parts can help us improve our energy efficiency?
Finally, Yupa's product of the future is revealed. The solar CD player is simple and elegant. The player will charge indoors when left near a window. And the system is uniquely versatile. It will work with any energy-efficient appliance Yupa designs. But one question remains. Will the world embrace Chinese solar products?
We want to bring what people originally thought of as an industrial thing and truly integrate it into their daily lives to enable consumers to truly experience solar energy. This is a very magical energy concept.
If these innovative products succeed, Yupa could achieve its dream, a dream it shares with China, to be the factory of the world.
I want consumers and everyone to have faith in our products and faith in the workers. I hope everyone can enjoy the products we produce. This will make us proud.
With Factory City in full swing and new products in the works, more and more goods will carry the Made in China label. But for China and Factory City, growth comes at a cost. Every day, the 17,000 people at Yupa endure the stress and uncertainty of a cutthroat world economy. To fight off fierce competitors and build a better life, these men and women work and live together as one at the factory of the world.
In rural Swaziland, communities without electricity now have the means to preserve vaccines and medicines that were previously unavailable to them. VOA's Caroline Turner has more.
A refrigerator powered directly from a solar panel means drugs and even HIV testing kits can now be stored at the correct temperature in Swaziland villages without reliable electricity. The solar fridge is making an immediate impact in the country with the world's highest rate of HIV infection. The fridge was developed as part of the Solar Chill Initiative, an international campaign which helps deliver vaccines and refrigeration to parts of the world without reliable electricity. A group called the Fridge Factory in Swaziland developed a simple and environmentally friendly way of running a solar-powered refrigerator without using a storage battery. The system uses solar power to make ice while the sun shines, which then keeps the fridge cool overnight. Freezing water packs have the added advantage of being easy to maintain, according to Roy Singh, the company's technical director.
If you have a problem with water, or if there is a breakage in one of the packs, we just go to the nearest river, fill it up, and carry on.
The Fridge Factory solar refrigerators are now in use in some of Swaziland's most remote rural communities where electricity is unreliable. Nationally, 30% of the population of Swaziland is HIV positive, but in Nasoko, the number is 80%. Dr. Wisdom Chivia says the solar refrigerator means he can now keep HIV testing kits at his clinic in southern Swaziland, where they are most needed.
If we don't have a proper storage of those drugs and vaccines, we cannot keep them. So they couldn't receive them, and we were referring them to go to other areas. But now, because we have this refrigerator, we are keeping those things, then it's reliable.
The Fridge Factory does not use the chlorofluorocarbons that are known to deplete the ozone. It's converted its entire production to use environmentally friendly hydrocarbons instead. The company says the market for their fridge is growing fast as people realize the benefits. Carolyn Turner, VOA News.